And I had paid enough attention to Miracle over the years that because I knew we wanted to move to Germany, I knew she had a reputation among the journalists of being, they love to call her poker face, because she's very, very, very low key. You don't get a reaction out of her very often. And one of the journalists asked her what she was going to do, because this was clearly her final encounter working with President Obama in an official capacity. And she looked like she was about ready to break down in tears, because she was so, this was really hard for her. And I made a note of that. And I just said, this is really interesting. This is so uncharacteristic of her.
In this episode, we interview author Claudia Clark about her book, Dear Barack, that highlights the working relationship between former German Chancellor Angela Merkel and President Barack Obama. Then we also talked to her about what the U.S. and Europe should do about the current conflict between Russia and Ukraine. And then finally, we talk about her time as a community organizer with the group ACORN. This is Secular Left. Our guest today is Claudia Clark. She has worked on numerous political and social justice campaigns, including serving as a campaign manager for a school board measure in South San Francisco Unified Schools. She was a community organizer with ACORN, a field organizer for the South Bay Labor Organization, a field organizer for the South Dakota Campaign for Healthy Families. Her volunteerism includes many Democratic Party organizations, NAACP groups, Planned Parenthood, and Toastmasters International. And she has written a book, or she has wrote a book that is out now. It's called Dear Barack, and it highlights the working relationship between President Obama and German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Thank you, Claudia, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
As I said, your book is titled Dear Barack, highlights the working relationship between President Obama and German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who just recently retired from office. What inspired you to write the book?
Well, that's a kind of a long story, but the short version is I knew that I wanted to move to Berlin or Germany. That had been a lifelong goal of mine. But despite that, I don't speak German very well. I speak French and Spanish, but German is another story. And I happened to watch the final press conference in 2016. Obama was in Europe for his final presidential trip. It was post election. And I happened to turn the television on, and it was on. And I had paid enough attention to Merkel over the years that because I knew we wanted to move to Germany, I knew she had a reputation among the journalists of being, they love to call her poker face, because she's very, very, very low key. You don't get a reaction out of her very often. And one of the journalists asked her what she was going to do, because this was clearly her final encounter working with President Obama in an official capacity. And she looked like she was about ready to break down in tears, because she was so, this was really hard for her. And I made a note of that. And I just said, this is really interesting. This is so uncharacteristic of her. And so I just, I thought, okay, this is interesting, but I didn't think too much of it at the time. And again, this was in November of 2016. And then I just happened to turn on the television in March of 2017, when she made the first trip overseas she made her first visit to Washington after Trump had been elected, and when Trump wouldn't even shake her hand. And I saw the contrast, not just personally, I saw the contrast between the two, but the media just went wild. They were showing all over the media, they were showing pictures of Obama and Merkel together, and then they were contrasting it with Merkel and Trump together. And I thought it was pretty interesting and kind of funny. And then what the final straw, though, was when I learned in May of 2017, Obama's first official trip post-presidency was to Berlin. And he was going to visit Chancellor Merkel. Now, the invitation, it was for the 500th anniversary of Reformation, you know, which is, you know, a big deal in German history. And the invitation came from the Lutheran Church. It had nothing to do with Merkel or her office. But nonetheless, I thought it was really telling that the very first trip that he made post-presidency was to see Chancellor Merkel. And I remembered that other books had been written about other world leaders and their relationship, you know, FDR and Winston Churchill during World War II. And so I thought, well, I wonder if there is something to this relationship. And, you know, I knew we were moving to Germany. I don't speak the language. I needed something to do, that wouldn't interfere with my German classes. And so I began research, and the next thing I know, I have a 250-page manuscript.
And it just kind of came together quickly for you, or pretty much? And
writing it and researching it came pretty quickly initially, but getting it published was another story. There's a lot of sitting and waiting, and COVID kind of threw a monkey wrench into a lot of that. And so during COVID, when I had the manuscript was off to publishers and I was waiting to hear back, because it hadn't been published, I said, why don't we do a revision? So I added the COVID things, and, you know, address how the differences between how Trump handled COVID versus how Merkel and the European leaders handled it. So, you know, it took from start to finish, it took about 4 years, but I would say probably three of those years, it was waiting and there was transition. It wasn't constant writing. It took me, you know, between research and when I handed over to the first editor, it took about 7 or 8 months.
Okay. And we do know from the historical record that President Obama and Angela Merkel worked together quite often on different issues and different current events that were going on at the time during when he was in office. But they didn't share the same views on some of the issues. What was their biggest differences that you think might shock some people?
Well, first of all, I'll just to give a little history on the relationship between the two of them. They did not start off, most people know this, but they did not start off on the best of circumstances to begin with. You know, President Obama, at the time when he was just a candidate in July of 2008, he was going to Berlin and he wanted to speak before the Brandenburg Gate. And Chancellor Merkel, you know, he was an upcoming rock star. Everybody loved him. The German people loved him. The other European countries loved him. The one person that didn't like him was Merkel. She was very skeptical of him. She thought he was all talk. And she thought, you know, I like President Obama a lot, but he's very, very arrogant. And Merkel kind of agreed. You know, she thought he was full of himself, to be blunt. And so she denied him the opportunity to speak before Brandenburg Gate. And that kind of, she was the first person to kind of tell him no, and that didn't go over well. And so that was one of their relationship kind of got off on a rocky start to begin with. But once he was in office, one of the big, you know, issues that differences that they had was on how to get the economies back, the world economies back. Because as you can recall, he took office in 2008, the height of the global economic recession. And there was a big difference of opinion among world leaders on how to get the economy stimulated again. France and Germany were of the mindset that they wanted stricter regulations to ensure that this type of overspending didn't happen again. And on the other side, the United States and Great Britain wanted, they didn't want government regulations. They wanted more money pumped into the economies to help stimulate for job growth and for public services. So there was a lot of disconnect between the two of them on that to begin with. So that was one of the main main issues that they disagreed with on. The other thing in the later years of Obama's presidency was what to do about Ukraine, Russia, because in 2014, you know, it's known now that, you know, we talk about it a lot now because of what's going on in Russia right now. When Putin illegally annexed Crimea, President Obama was receiving a lot of pressure from Congress, from the Senate primarily, to engage militarily in, to help Ukraine fight militarily. And France and Germany were of the mindset, absolutely not. We cannot do this. We can't engage militarily because, well, they share a border with Russia for one thing, but for another, Merkel was of the mindset that you can't win a war against Russia militarily. At the time, that was kind of what was thought. So there was, and at the end of the day, Obama agreed and caved and said, no, we'll issue sanctions and we'll be strict about it, but we're not going to help militarily. But he was really getting closer and closer to engaging militarily. And so that was something that they disagreed with about. And then, of course, one thing that was really hard for me to, as a civil libertarian and someone that really respected Obama, that I dedicate an entire chapter to this, but it was known when the Eric Snowden events came out, with the leaks came out with about the alleged spying. Merkel was one of the people that was the biggest target of that, and it was revealed that Obama had had her, or his administration, I shouldn't say him personally, but his administration had her cell phone wiretapped. And so that was, she was not real happy about that for obvious reasons. And so they had to work, Obama had to do a lot of mending of fences to fix that problem because of a mistake that his administration made.
Okay. And you mentioned that about what is currently happening in Ukraine and about the previous annexation of Crimea. How do you see Europe responding to it this time? Then it's different than before. Are they more on our side now, or on our page, or are they trying to do the same thing?
Well, what's interesting is that back in 2014, their primary goal, Europe and even the United States, so I should say all of the allies, their primary goal was to hit Putin where it hurt, what they thought financially. So they did other things. You know, they issued sanctions against Russia for, they were trying to ruin the Russian economy. And they also did other things, like they kicked Russia out of the G8 or the G7 used to be the G8. And one of the things that they did was they kicked Russia out because of his annexation of Crimea. And they moved the Special Olympics, were supposed to be held in Russia. They wouldn't do that. They moved them to another location because of that. So there were tactical things that they did. But I think one thing where they really made a mistake is now that the war has happened and we're seeing all the devastation now, Germany, mostly Germany, but other European countries have been reluctant to issue hardcore sanctions against Russia because they relied on them for a lot of the energy, nuclear and other energy. And I think that is, I have a lot of respect for Merkel, but one of the things I do think they could have done is when Putin annexed Crimea, what the European countries should have done is they should have started getting their act together then to say, okay, we can't trust Putin. We have to be careful. And they should have started making plans at that point to find alternative ways of getting the energy that they needed. Now that the time has come, they're acting like they're caught with their pants around their ankles because they're acting unprepared, like Putin has done all these nasty things. You know, this war is devastating, but we need to rely on Russia, so we can't really, we're limited in what we can do. When they could have done something, they were warned in 2014 that Putin can do this. And so I do think that they should have done a little more than they did. And to the surprise of a lot of people, they've been bending over backwards, trying to, supply Ukraine with what they need. Germany's coming around. Schultz was a little wishy-washy up front, but I think he could be doing more. But one of the reasons the European leaders have been working so hard is I think they feel guilty, because it's like we saw this coming and we should have done more and we didn't.
And following along that similar line of thought, we pretty much experienced how President Trump pretty much destroyed the relationship with our allies during his term of office, including that classic photograph of Merkel and the other G7s ganging up on mm-hmm. Trump when he's sitting down at a table. Do you see the Biden administration restoring that relationship, and can it be repaired?
Yes, it's going to take some time. Trump did a lot. As someone that lives over here, lives in Germany now, and I see it on a daily basis, Trump did a lot of damage to the relationship between the United States and our allies. But one of the things that was reassuring was after the election was called, and they called it in favor of Biden, there were tweets and from European leaders across the world. You know, the mayor of France sent out a tweet saying the United States is back. There were church bells that went off in different parts of Germany. Were at the time, I'm living in Berlin now, but at the time I was living outside of Munich, and there were church bells and celebrations. So I think people were relieved because they figured they could deal with 4 years of Trump, but the big scare was if he got reelected, what was going to happen if he had 4 more years. And so there was an overwhelming sense of relief when Biden won. And I think one of the things that I've noticed about Biden leading up to what's going on in Ukraine is he's done an amazing job of rallying our allied leaders together around how to deal with Putin. You know, for the most part, they've all been in lockstep with how to deal with Putin, with regard to sanctions, with regard to providing military aid. They've all, and I think Biden has done a tremendous job of getting everybody on the same page with that.
For more information about any of the topics covered in this episode, check out our show notes at secularleft.us. If you don't mind, I'd like to move into your history of activism that you've done. And I noticed in your bio that you had worked for ACORN. Mm-hmm. And for people that don't know who ACORN is, because in the United States it's kind of defunct now, it stood for Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. And it was a nonprofit that worked on voter registration, community organizing, and advocacy for low and moderate income people. And it was targeted back in, really, there were several years back in the early aughts of 2000 by right-wing conservatives. And in 2009, some heavily edited hidden videos came out that showed some ACORN employees in a bad light, and that caused them eventually to declare bankruptcy and go out of business. Did you work for ACORN during that time when it was being targeted?
I was there. I'm trying to think. I was there just as it was picking up steam. There was a lot of controversy over, you know, they were being targeted because they were the right thought that people were, the organizers were registering people that didn't exist. You know, they were turning in voter registration cards for Scooby-Doo and that kind of thing. That was kind of, I was in during that period of time, but I left for medical reasons shortly. I was there, I think 2008, 2009. So I left right before it got as controversial and before the right wing really, really went after it.
Yeah. And people don't realize that the right has been targeting voter registration groups for years. And this was just in a long line of targeting. And what these hidden videos were supposedly showing employees making like trying to suggest illegal acts and things like that. And it was nothing of the sort. All of the accusations were investigated and the employees were cleared by all of the law enforcement agencies that took a look at it.
Right.
But it blew up the group.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was the point. And they even had a bill in Congress that stripped money from Acorn.
Yeah.
You know.
And well, and not only Acorn was on their radar for a lot of reasons, because when I was there in 2007, 2008, this again, it was at the height of the economic recession. And we were one of the primary things we did, and one of the things I did as an organizer was we tried to, when people were losing their homes because they had received mortgages that they never were qualified for. That was one of the big problems with the fallouts of the economic recession. And one of the things we did as organizers at Acorn was we would do everything we could to keep people in their homes. We would go to the bank, we'd protest banks for bad mortgages. We fought for things like national health care or for the Affordable Care Act. I was working there when that was going through Congress. And so we were, as a left organization, we were a couple of hot button issues that the right really did not like. And so they did what they could to discredit us.
Yeah. And I just thought it was, bad thing that they did in targeting the group. And now correct me, you said you worked on the housing, but you didn't work on the voter registration.
I did. Yeah. We usually as organizers, we had several campaigns that we worked on. And so my main goal was the mortgages and healthcare. And I also tried to get people to join, and I did a lot of the neighborhood stuff. So I would go out to the different neighborhoods and where we lived in South San Francisco to find out what the neighborhoods needed. So that was primarily what I did. But that isn't to say when I wasn't out trying to get support for national health care or for the mortgage issue, if people weren't registered to vote, I was able to, that was, I had voter registration cards that I carried with me, and we registered people to vote. That was just kind of part of our daily work.
So basically, as a community organizer, you went and knocked on doors and talked to people.
Yeah. Yeah. And to find out what they want, because I was in South San Francisco as a lower economic community and in Daly City area. And we went out to find out what people wanted, and it was a lot of what I did was just what they wanted at the local level. For example, where one of the areas that I was responsible for organizing was very, very dangerous because you couldn't, the people parked on both sides of the street and there was no parking and you're up on hills. And so people couldn't see. And so there were a lot of accidents were happening. So one of the tasks I was assigned to do is hold a community meeting with people so that we could just try and get in those mirrors that you could put on the streets so that you could see when you were backing up, you could see traffic. So I would do things like that. I would organize community meetings where we could talk about doing things like that. And then as an organizer, what my task was really not to speak for the people, but to teach them how to do it themselves, how to contact their elected officials, how to go into a city council meeting and advocate for themselves, because many people didn't know how to do that or were intimidated by it. And so that's what we would do, is we would have meetings on, okay, this is your state representative. This is how you address them. When you go and you talk to them, this is what you say. And that was a large part of what we did as well.
And what was your favorite part of community organizing?
For me, it's interesting because I'm an introvert. I small talk and one-on-ones is not my thing, but I like, as a community organizer, I like going up and holding the community meetings with 500 people, and many of whom, we were dealing with, in the Northern California area, we were dealing with people who were immigrants who, this was the first time they'd never voted before because they hadn't been eligible or whatever. And so I liked going into a group of people new into the community and talking to them and telling them, you are citizens. This is what you can do, and getting them excited and getting them engaged and getting them riled up. I could do that all day long. And I can't do it anymore, but there was a time I could do it in Spanish as well. So that was really exciting. And you see these new citizens who never ever voted before in their entire lives, registering to vote or actually voting for the first time and seeing that. So that was really exciting to me, because that is, for me as an activist, that's one of my biggest things is voting. I have pretty high tolerance for everything, but people not voting. I don't have any use for people who don't vote just because they don't want to, and especially women and minorities. It's one of those things where women were force fed for the right to vote. And for women not to vote, I think it's just a slap in the face to all the women who fought. And similarly, how many times was John Lewis arrested so African Americans could vote? So that was, that's what I tried. That's my passion, is trying to get people, convincing them of the importance of voting.
All right. And as we wrap up today, what bit of wisdom or last thoughts would you like to leave us with?
Right now, I think there's a lot of controversy, a lot of frustration right now going on in the United States about what's happened with the Supreme Court and Roe versus Wade. And I think there's a lot of finger pointing, and the bottom line is, a lot of people, I think, sometimes voting is a matter of plugging your nose and voting for a candidate that a lesser of two evils. And unfortunately, that's the way it is. And sometimes you have to, and a lot of people didn't vote in the 2016 election because they didn't think Trump would ever get elected. And as it turns out, the people that didn't vote are the ones responsible for Trump. And I think I do think that people oftentimes are pickier about who they're going to vote for than who they're going to date. And sometimes you just have to look at I think it's really important that you look at the broad picture. And okay, you don't like a candidate, this candidate supports the death penalty and you don't support the death penalty, but they're good on immigration, they're good on women's rights, they're good on minimum wage, but people don't vote because of that one issue. And sometimes you just have to look past that. And our democracy is hanging by a thread. And I think now more than ever, and I know it's easier said than done to tell people how important it is to vote and that they need to vote with all these voter registration restriction laws going into effect. But really just look at the greater picture and look what could happen if you don't vote, and just how important it is to vote. Because if you don't, it could be the last election. The 2022 midterm could be one of the last elections we're eligible to vote in.
Very well said. I appreciate that, because that's pretty much how I feel sometimes when those issues are coming up. And again, Claudia, I really thank you for your time. And your book is called Dear Barack, and it is available from your website. And is it also through Amazon and booksellers?
Yes. If you go to my website, the ISBN is on there so that you can go to your local mom and pop bookstore and order it. If you would like, you can order it on Amazon, or you can get it from Barnes & Noble, or you can get it from my publisher as well.
Okay. And again, thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode. You can check out more information, including links to sources used, in our show notes on our website at secularleft.us. Secular Left is hosted, written, and produced by Doug Berger, and he is solely responsible for the content. Send us your comments, either using the contact form on the website or by sending us a note at comments@secularleft.us. Our theme music is Dank and Nasty, composed using Amplify Studio. See you next time.